is CoDiscovery. Hello and welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. Observing things we can't understand, frustrating or intriguing? From rabbits plucked out of hats to dark matter, how do we comprehend the inexplicable or the unobservable? What do particle physicists and a magician's audience have in common? Do we enjoy being baffled? And if so, why? What pushes us to seek to understand? And is objectivity so vital in scientific observation? Is subjectivity really its negation? Or is the relation between the two more subtle? If you're intrigued by how we process the unexpected and search for the invisible, then you're in the right place. Let me introduce this episode's three guests who have been funded under the EU's Horizon 2020 programme. Together, we'll be exploring philosophical approaches behind science and the interplay between reality, illusion, objectivity, and subjectivity. So, welcome to Jason Leddington, who is an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. He worked on the Philo Magic project, and his book on the philosophy of magic and other arts of impossibility is under contract with MIT Press, with the working title, The Art of the Impossible. Welcome, Jason.
Hi, Abigail. Great to be with you.
Michaela Massimi is Professor of Philosophy of Science at the University of Edinburgh and was the principal investigator of a project called Perspectival Realism, Science, Knowledge and Truth from a Human Vantage Point. She is the author of Perspectival Realism, which will come out in January 2022, published by the Oxford University Press. Welcome, Michaela.
Hi, Abigail. Very nice to be here.
Jan Sprenger is professor at the Centre for Logic, Language and Cognition at the University of Turin. His area of interest is the relationship between scientific inference, public trust, and the role of objectivity, which he explored in his project, Objectivity. Hello, Jan.
Hi, Abigail. Great to meet you.
Thank you all for being here. So, let's get cracking. Jason, in your paper, The Experience of Magic, on which the Philo Magic project was based, one of the things you do is to set out a systematic and theoretically rigorous account of what goes on in the mind of someone who witnesses a good magic trick. Magic is one of the oldest and most consistently popular genres of theatrical performance. Why do you think that is? Why do we enjoy being baffled?
It's a really great question. I think it goes right to the heart of my project, which really began with my own experience performing magic and noticing that some people really love it and others really hate it. And to be fair, most people really love it, but the range of reactions you get to a strong magic trick are pretty incredible. And they're also often strongly emotional. So the question just arose, why are people attracted to this? And on the usual story, of course, people aren't attracted to things that they don't understand, especially things that they have no hope of understanding. But precisely the point of magic is to provide us with experiences that, if the magic is very good, we have no hope of making sense of either now or at any point in the future. So the question that I really wanted to explore then is, why would anyone want to see a good magic show? I think that understanding this reveals something not only about magic, but about the human mind. In particular, I think it highlights something that every scientist and scholar knows, if only implicitly, namely that the energy that drives inquiry is not the pleasure we take in final explanations, but the energy and excitement of curiosity itself.
That's really very interesting. And you mentioned curiosity. What role do you feel that plays? Do you think it's the curiosity that actually subdues the possible feeling of resentment at being baffled? Do you think that this curiosity overcomes that feeling of resentment in some people or most people?
I think that curiosity is a pleasant affective experience. And one of the interesting things about recent work on curiosity, and one of the things that my project highlights, is that curiosity has traditionally been conceived merely as a kind of intellectual condition. And recent work has highlighted the emotional and affective dimensions of curiosity. And this really comes out in the experience of magic. So let's think a little bit about how this works in the case of encountering a magic trick. So normally when you walk around the world, you don't understand everything you see, but everything fits together intuitively. The world works according to pretty much your set of intuitive expectations. When you encounter a magic trick, you encounter what I like to call an experiential anomaly, something that just disrupts your ordinary intuitive understanding of how the world works. And outside of a theatrical context, that could be threatening, quite unpleasant. It could prompt you to try to revise, say, physical theory. But in a theatrical context, this is a place where you can actually enjoy having your curiosity stimulated without the burden of trying to satisfy it. So what I think that goes on in magic performance and why some people really enjoy it is that they enjoy having their curiosity stimulated. They don't mind the experience of ignorance because they understand this is a theatrical context and not an ordinary everyday one where their epistemic status or standing is actually threatened by what they're experiencing. So taking that into account, they can now actually enjoy the magic trick as, in the end, ideally, a kind of endless source of curiosity.
And wonder.
Stimulation. And wonder, right. So it's something that even long after that people have experienced a magic trick, they can think back on it and have their curiosity once again stimulated. And this is one of the reasons why you'll encounter people who will tell you about magic tricks they experienced 50 years ago and related in detail, precisely because that experiential anomaly has stuck with them. It stimulates the curiosity. They've been able to carry it with them and continue to enjoy it even over a long period of time. I think other people don't get, as it were, the theatrical context, take the magic trick too seriously, not as a form of play. And so they experience it as a form of epistemic threat.
Or challenge, yeah. And where do the inexplicable and the unobservable overlap in our thought processes, do you think?
So I think this is really interesting, actually, right? So suppose that encountered a magic performance and you took it seriously as an object of scientific investigation. And on investigating it, you discovered that there were no methods that we could make sense of for, say, how this apparent telekinesis took place. So you decided, well, actually, this isn't a magic trick at all. This is real telekinesis. In other words, suppose magic was real. If magic was real, there would be a science of it. And the science of it would potentially involve postulating on observables. So if telekinesis was something that was real, then we'd have to potentially postulate unobservable entities to explain how minds can interact with matter at a distance. So the postulation of unobservables is part of explaining observable things we can't otherwise make sense of.
Absolutely. Okay, that's fascinating. Thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to put to Jason?
Yes, I would like to ask Jason the following question.
Certainly, Michaela.
How do you see the relation between magic and what we can't see? And in particular, where does the invisible world end being the remit of magic and becomes the remit of science?
I think I want to say that the invisible world is always the realm of science, and that the realm of magic is a space of play, as it were. And when it is no longer a space of play, that's when it becomes the realm of science. So a good friend of mine and an important magician and essayist, Jamie Ian Swiss, describes magic as a burlesque of science. So it's not that I think of the realm of magic as, say, the realm of Harry Potter over here alongside the world of science over here. It's rather that magic as an art form plays with the very same types of impulses and approaches to the world that we engage with in a serious way when we do science.
Does anyone else have any questions for Jason?
Yes, I would.
Yes, Jan, go ahead.
Thank you very much. So I'm curious what distinguishes, from a cognitive point of view, a good magic trick from a bad magic trick.
It's a terrific question. And I'll start with a famous quote or a famous idea from a great late magician named Simon Aronson, which is that he says that there's a world of difference between not knowing how something is done and knowing that something can't be done. So when you experience a magic trick, if you can walk away from it saying, yeah, it could have been wires, it could have been magnets, it could have been a trick deck or a gimmicked coin, then the magic trick isn't successful. It's true, you're still in a position of ignorance, but you have candid explanations for what you witnessed. The job of the magician is to erase all candidate explanations in your mind and leave you completely baffled. So cognitively, the position you should be in is one of what Socrates and Plato would have called aporia, total speechlessness. You no longer know what to say. You know it's a trick, but you don't see how it could be because you have no candidate explanations.
And Michaela, I mean, if we think about the work that you've been doing, so I'm going to turn to you. You were exploring how our notion of the word realism relates to experimental work and perspectives in science. What drew you to the area of realism as it relates to experimental work? And why do you feel that there was something important to acknowledge?
I've always been fascinated by questions about realism in science, in the sense that I'm interested in questions about what is real and how do we go about finding out about what is real. And one of the problems in the philosophy of science is that often if we look back at the history of science, we find out that the best theories that we used to believe to be true in the past that turn out to be false. So we used to believe in the ether, and we used to believe in caloric, we used to believe in phlogiston and lots of other stuff, but that turn out to be false. So the question that really guided my project was not so much whether science can deliver a true story about nature. I think that the answer is yes. That's why it's called perspectival realism. But the question is how we go about finding out what is real. So I was interested in how particle physicists at CERN, for example, go about finding out new particles that, to the best of our knowledge, we believe must be real, but for which we haven't found any evidence yet. And what kind of models, what kind of statistical methods, what kind of data they use to explore what we haven't explored yet, to find out what's in unobservable.
Sure. And did you speak with many?
Yes, I did. So we went to CERN with my postdoc, my PhD student, and we had the chance to talk to both theoretical physicists and experimental physicists working at both the ATLAS and the CMS experiments, which are some of the two biggest experiments at CERN, and ask them questions about their methodology, share their views, and getting to know more about their methods and methodologies and modeling practices that they use, which was really fascinating because it informed the result of the project.
Ah, and what are the things with regards to a historical perspective did you feel was important to uncover and discuss in your project?
So there isn't just a contemporary element to the project of perspectival realism. It isn't just about how contemporary physicists at CERN or the Dark Energy Survey, which was the other big communities that we work with in cosmology, are currently looking for evidence for unobservable entities, like candidate particles for dark matter, for example, or what is dark energy. We were also interested in the historical aspect of this question, namely how communities of the past went about finding out new entities and exploring new realms that were up to the point not known.
That's very interesting, Michaela. And what drew you to the area of perspectival realism? What did you understand by the meaning, or what do you want to set out by the meaning of the word perspectival?
So the word perspectival realism really wants to capture this idea that there is a plurality of scientific perspective that matters to science and to scientific knowledge and how we produce scientific knowledge. So it's a way of responding to traditional realist view that have portrayed realism as a God's eye view of nature, and a way of rediscovering the profoundly social and collaborative nature of scientific knowledge, where at the center stage are really historically and culturally situated epistemic communities, be they particle physicists in contemporary science or Victorian physicists in Cambridge. So there is an important historical component, not just a contemporary one, in this project. We spent effectively 2 years doing field work with physicists at CERN and the cosmologists at the Dark Energy Survey, but then we spent also solid 2 years doing more historical research on the history of science. And that's because, again, if you look back at the history of science, very often the way we have asked the question about realism goes from theories to unobservable entities. Were the theories of the past true or false? What happens about those unobservable objects that they postulated and that turn out to be false? But if you look more closely at the history of science, what we are missing is an important bottom-up approach, how scientists went from specific data to phenomena and from phenomena to natural kinds, even if they might have had
sometimes false beliefs about those objects. So that's the case with J.J. Thomson, who has gone down in history as the discoverer of the electron. But effectively, he had all sorts of false belief about that particle, which he called the corpuscle at the time, because the term electron was used to indicate a particular view about those objects that were embedded in their theory. So what J.J. Thomson got it right was that there was a modally robust phenomenon. There was the bending of cathode rays, this experiment that he ran in Cambridge in 1897, using a glass tube with vacuum inside. And he was able to observe how this fluorescence was able to be bent in the presence of an electric or magnetic field. And he was able to make an inference from that to the existence of a particle that must have had a negative charge and must have been really, really small, the first subatomic particle to be discovered. So perspectival realism is really a way of approaching realism, not necessarily from theories to unobservable entities, but bottom up from the data to the phenomena, to the natural kinds, in a way that is sensitive to the historical nuances of communities at a particular time.
Okay, that's great. Okay, and in the knowledge and the understanding that certain ideas gain traction, other ideas fall by the wayside, but that it's a community of people, not necessarily directly working together, that build knowledge, essentially. What would you wish that we should reconsider in the light of your findings?
So there are three things that I really wish we could reconsider. So the first is really a rediscovery of the role of local knowledge and what sometimes I call artisanal knowledge that was really instrumental to scientific knowledge production. We remember Maxwell, we remember Einstein, we remember Thomson, but we don't remember the people that made those discoveries possible. So J.J. Thomson had a professionally trained glass blower at the Cavendish Lab in Cambridge, whose name was Ebenezer Everett. And that artisanal knowledge was instrumental at the time for the very possibility of doing electrical researches of the type that Thomson was doing. So perspectival realism is a way of really being sensitive to those historical nuances. The second is a change in the way we approach the metaphysics of nature. So I've already mentioned this change from the top-down view, theories to entity, to a bottom-up view from data to phenomena to natural kinds. And the third is changing attitudes towards why we care so much about science. And I think we care so much about science, not so much because science is necessarily delivering some kind of certainty or objective and final image about the way the world is, but because there is something incredible about how finite human beings like us have the resources at each historical point in time to make reliable inferences over time. And I think it's a way of giving credit to those epistemic communities over time that no matter what false belief they had, they were nonetheless able to make advancement in our knowledge of the world.
Yeah, contributing to an overall jigsaw puzzle almost, I think. Yeah, yeah. Does anybody have any questions for Michaela? Yeah, Jason, please go ahead.
This is really interesting, and I'm wondering a bit about how it is that scientific explanations or pseudoscientific explanations get distinguished, how types of explanations or phenomena get discredited on your model. So I'm thinking in particular here from the perspective of the magician. Magicians were, in the late 19th century, became important for debunking spiritualist phenomena, pseudo-psychic phenomena, and that's continued throughout the 20th century. And so we have paranormal psychology developing in the early 20th century, and that gets discredited. How does that work on your model?
Well, that's an excellent question and a tricky one too, because it takes us right to the heart of what is science and the demarcation problem. In a way, I'm operating with a very generous notion of a scientific perspective as the historically, culturally embedded scientific practice of a community. One thing I do in the book and in my work is I explicitly say, for example, that what I really mean by scientific practice is the experimental, theoretical modeling resources available at the time to make those inferences. So, for example, I wouldn't include in the definition of a perspective metaphysical beliefs that people might have at the time. because although those beliefs played an absolutely key role in, for example, whether or not the community accepted some theories at the time, what the notion of scientific perspective does is to provide us with a tool for understanding the reliability of the inferences that we draw. So I'm trying to make that line, if you like, in the way I define the notion of a scientific perspective. But also I see pluralism in science, this plurality of perspective. There isn't just one perspective at one time. There is a plurality of perspective at any one time. And I see that pluralism as having a sort of self-refining role. It is because we have that plurality of perspective that we can have a robust scientific knowledge that improves and becomes more reliable over time. So in the case of J.J. Thomson, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Victorian Cambridge of the time was imbued with spiritualistic beliefs about the ether and all sorts of paranormal phenomena, right? It's the sort of area on which historians of science obviously have done a lot of important research. I guess the question that matters to me from a kind of epistemology of science point of view is, what is it that J.J. Thomson got it right in his inferences? And how can we bring other perspective, for example, the perspective of people working in electrochemistry or people that were working at the time in quantum theory with Max Planck, to bear on the work that J.J. Thomson was doing? And how is it that this intersection of scientific perspective eventually led to the inferences that we did produce?
Do you think of, say, the Cambridge glassblower, or of, say, you know, Houdini's work in debunking pseudopsychics? Are they contributing to the constitution of scientific perspectives in your sense, or are they external to that process? They're important, but they're not actually, as it were, part of the scientific process per se?
So glass blowers, or, you know, beekeepers, or any kind of artisanal knowledge that is instrumental to producing that kind of knowledge, in the sense that we need a cathode ray tube in the first instance to be able to run a J.J. Thomson experiment, is part of a scientific perspective. Now, what kind of beliefs, say, J.J. Thomson as a person, as human beings, might have had at the time about the electron? I mean, his personal beliefs, his metaphysical beliefs and so forth, that's not a part of a scientific perspective as I intended. So, for example, he believed that, you know, the atom was a sort of plum puddings, where the corpuscle, as he called it, was distributed inside a mostly positive charge. So I thought that, you know, we need to wait to Rutherford and his experiment to have the solar model of the atoms. So at the time of J.J. Thomson, they were operating with a completely different model. So he had all sorts of beliefs that we nowadays would regard as false. But what he got it right was the kind of inference he made about the existence of a charge to mass ratio of a particle that must have been a very small subatomic particle and with a negative charge. And to do that, Ebenezer Everett, the official glass blower at the Cavendish Lab, was an instrumental part of that story. So I would like to give credit to those kind of communities of artisanal knowledge that provided the technological resources for making that possible.
It's nice to have the man's name so clearly set out. It feels like a forgotten name in science. Now we know the name, Ebenezer Everett, not one to be forgotten.
Which is quite a remarkable name.
Yeah, it's a great name for a kind of a lost figure. Jason, sorry, yeah, do you have something else you want to
ask? Yeah, can I ask a quick follow-up there? Yeah, so I guess I'm wondering if your view involves acknowledging their importance for the scientific process, which seems pretty uncontroversial, or if it involves breaking down in some significant way the boundaries between scientific activity and so-called non-scientific activity. So I guess my question is really, should we think of the glass blower as in some way a scientist?
Yeah, going back to Ebenezer Everett and J.J. Thomson, I call them epistemic communities, not scientists, partially because the term, you know, scientist is a very late term that was really introduced, I think, at the end of the 19th century, if I remember correctly. And a better word for it is epistemic communities, communities of epistemic agents that are capable of producing and contributing to the production of scientific knowledge. So yes, I would consider Ebenezer Everett, glass blowers, people whose artisanal practices were instrumental to those advancement as epistemic communities. They were historically situated, they used the tools of the time, and they were an integral part of this knowledge production.
So it's a wider picture. It's a more global picture.
Yes,
it's a more global
picture.
And that merging of margins, I think, also in a way feeds into the idea of trust a little. Jan, I'd like to bring you in here, please, if I may. The Objectivity Project, clues in the name, looked into whether by building up the importance of objectivity as a feature of research, we've set up a false dichotomy between objective and subjective analysis. And in fact, whether this is something researchers should be focused on. I'd like to explore that concept with you. And I'd also like to consider, bearing in mind our recent conversations we've been having, the notion of trust and Michaela's idea of plurality, that leads to a sensation of trust, the feeling that thoughts and ideas refined by various thinkers, that builds into the notion of trust. So could you tell me a little bit about your concept in the Objectivity Project? It sounds positively heretical to say that scientific research shouldn't be rigorously objective. Why did you feel the need to challenge that assumption?
Well, first of all, I think that the label objective raises too high expectations. So it hides that science is essentially fallible. And of course, science is more often right than it's not, and it's maybe our most reliable source of knowledge, but mistakes do happen, or sometimes just bad luck in science. And putting the objective label on scientific knowledge makes it sound as if it was certified infallible knowledge, which then makes it very hard to explain why failures do happen, and it makes it in a rather easy game for science skeptics like the former president of the United States, Donald Trump. And to give you an example, so in science, the concept of statistical significance, which is a quite technical concept, which I won't explain, has often been used to qualify knowledge as objective, but independent of its technical meaning, it does not give the answer to questions. Does this effect which we observe really make a practical difference? Is it useful for solving our problems? And I think if you want to answer this question, the perspectives which Michaela mentioned, so the perspectives of different communities, different research traditions, have to be taken into account. And I am using, I'm working on a quite similar project like Michaela in the realm of statistical inference in particular.
Okay, this is a closed book to me, and I'm absolutely fascinated by this. I mean, if I think of the word statistics, to me, I mean, I know they can be interpreted and they can be manipulated, but the bare statistics themselves, to me, that sounds like that's something factual. That's not subjective or objective. Tell me a little bit more about the notion of subjectivity and statistics, because to me, that seems a little bit of an interesting combination of words.
Well, there is a strong research tradition in statistics which has tried to clean statistics of all explicit subjective elements to the extent that a scientist's subjective opinion or the particular theoretical framework in which he or she is working are affecting the statistical inference, that inference becomes invalid or less trustworthy than an inference which does not make reference to such theoretical backgrounds, for example, to such, let's say, subjective elements.
And what was the Objectivity Project setting out to do in relation to that?
Well, we are trying to argue that the so-called subjective inference, which is in the realm of statistics often associated with it, labeled Bayesian, with Bayesian inference, can actually do the job which most people and most users of science would expect from the label of objective. It can help to provide reliable inferences. It makes the subjective elements explicit. So if you want to criticize an inference, if you don't agree with the results, you know, let's say you can also track the disagreement to the sources, right? And I think it's very important to be transparent about what is, let's say, subjective or perspectival, to use Michaela's terms, in an inference, and what is, for example, just mathematics. And I think only if we make these points explicit, we will be able to appreciate the degree to which inferences can be shared among all science users, among all members of society, and to which extent there is room for genuine and rational disagreement.
So are you saying then that the subjective is inherent essentially, and that by not acknowledging that, we remove the ability to discuss it and to discuss its importance and to discuss its impact on the interpretation of the statistics involved?
Exactly.
Right. And I guess then tell me a little bit more about your theories with regards to trust and the vital necessity of maintaining public trust in scientific output. How does this play in with that?
Now, in the last years, we have seen, especially in the social science, a so-called replication crisis, which means if there has been a systematic project to replicate experimental findings from various areas of social science, psychology in particular, and what these systematic replications, which have been done by other research teams, not by the original researchers, have yielded is that very often the what has been statistically significant in the original experiment is not significant anymore, and the effect sizes are much lower. So this has, of course, shaken the trust in science. And one of the causes of the replication crisis is, in my view, as a philosopher of science, is that for evaluating whether an effect is real, people are using the wrong standards, standards which have been shaped by this, in my view, mistaken conception of scientific objectivity. And we are trying to improve this and to help scientists and science users by developing better methods for scientific inference, and by, in particular, by arguing that scientists don't have to be afraid of explicit subjective elements in their inferences. It's good to have them, and it's good to make them explicit.
And that's what I was about to say. Yeah, the key word there is explicit.
Exactly. So let's say statistically, there are various techniques for how you can encode your prior knowledge or your theoretical expectations. And of course, about these things, scientists often disagree. But let's say a subjective statistical framework gives them, let's say, the opportunity to see, let's say, how these different expectations are compatible with the data, which, let's say, so-called objective or mistakenly objective framework doesn't do.
Can you give me a bit of an example? I mean, what sort of domain? You mentioned sort of psychology generally, but could you give me an example of where this absolute overriding desire to be objective at all costs actually undermines the validity of the results or our interpretation of those results, at least? Do you understand my question?
There are also, yes, sure. There are some cases in medicine, for example, where, of course, effect size, so let's say, does the drug not only make some difference, which we can tell from no difference at all, but does it make a substantial difference is to help patients to recover, is quite important. And often, let's say, the traditional statistical frameworks answer the wrong question, namely, is there an effect at all, or can we tell with some certainty whether the effect is not equal to zero? But what science users want to know, and our patients want to know, and their doctors want to know, is whether these effects have a certain practical significance. And these questions are much easier to answer if you work with explicit subjective assumptions, or much easier to model. Perhaps.
Yeah, that's excellent. Thank you. That makes it much clearer. Indeed. Work, but how and how well? Thank you. Thank you very much. Michaela, would you have any questions that you would like to ask Jan?
Yes. For my work, for Perspectival Realism, one thing we did wasn't just to work with physicists at CERN, but also with cosmologists involved in the Dark Energy Survey, which was a survey, one of the largest observational cosmology survey to find evidence for the existence of dark energy. Bayesianism is one of the most ubiquitous statistical inferences used by cosmologists today. So I just would like you to say something about how your work and your research may be important and relevant for cosmology and for other area of research.
Jan, before you answer, Michaela, could I ask you also to give a little bit of explanation about what Bayesianism means?
Bayesianism, or Bayesian inference, is a school of statistical reasoning or statistical inference based on the idea that you start out with a representation of our subjective theoretical knowledge or expectations, and that this representation of our knowledge is changed as we come to know new things, as we conduct experiments and observe data. And there's a particular mathematical formula describing this change of our beliefs, which is called Bayes' theorem. And it is indeed, I think, the most successful attempt of making subjective elements in statistics explicit. And that's why I'm also advocating its use a lot. And if the cosmologists are already on board, then good for them. I think not using them will actually lead us to an overestimation of what we actually know, as opposed to how many of our findings are actually truthful and trustworthy.
Right. So it's almost like a way of writing in transparency at source.
Yes.
Yeah. Very interesting. That's excellent.
I do think that also for the communication of scientific results, it is much better to, instead of p-values, which nobody understands, so these are the so-called statistical significance level, another name for them is p-values. Instead of these very arcane and often misinterpreted quantities, it is much better to use Bayes factors, which is basically explain how much the actual evidence or the results of a particular experiment would shift your beliefs in favor of a particular hypothesis. Because this is something that also ordinary people can relate to much better. Would this evidence really shift my beliefs? And if so, by which degree?
Very good. Very, very good. That's all been very interesting. Thank you very much. I found that a stimulating episode of this Core Discovery podcast. I think we come away with the idea that the boundaries are a little bit more blurred between what we can know and what we can assume and guess, and how we go about establishing the unknown and how we acknowledge that we might be being swayed. I think this has all been fascinating. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's been super interesting.
It has been, hasn't it? Excellent. Well, I wish you all the very best in all the work that you're doing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Abigail. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Abigail.
Thanks, Abigail.
Bye-bye.
Are you interested in what other EU-funded projects are doing in the field of philosophy? Take a look at the special section From Socrates to Modern Science, New Perspectives in European Philosophy, of issue 105 of the Research EU magazine, available on the Cordis website, cordis.europa.eu. The Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by the Horizon 2020 programme. Find daily news articles and interviews with researchers working in a very broad range of domains, from archaeology to zoology. Results packs drill down deeper, gathering groups of projects by subject area, and the magazine offers insights into a different subject every month in its special section. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Take a look at what others are doing in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you, so drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.